The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Case studies of acid-base disorders is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
The first case I'm going to talk about is, and you'll notice that the lungs are curiously absent because they're just a dumb organ that does nothing. So we don't really worry about the lungs in acid-base disorders. So it's a 40-year-old man. He presents to the ER with coma. You can see he's pretty sick. His pH is 7.14. His PCO2 is 15. K is 6.4. Chloride is 100. Bicarbonate is 5. Blood sugar is 100. BUN is 18. His osmolarity is 340 measured. But he didn't drink, which is an abnormality in Scranton. So we never see those cases that they have a blood alcohol level of zero. So I can probably report that. His fundoscopic exam shows optic neuritis, and how would you approach the differential diagnosis of this disorder? So let's first off go through the problem solving. So is this an acidosis or an alkalosis? Is obviously an acidosis. Is it because of, is it a metabolic problem or in respiratory? Well, we're here, it's metabolic, right? We're not talking about those lungs. Is compensation appropriate? Yes. Is the anion gap high? Yes, it is. It's 23. Is the change in gap equal to change in bicarbonate? Yes, it does. So it's just a simple metabolic acidosis. And then finally, is there an osmolar gap? And in this case, yes. Just the bottom of there, you can see that there is a way to correct it for albumin, because albumin is the most common unmeasured anion. How many of you guys know a thing called mud piles? Raise your hand if you know mud piles. Forget mud piles, okay? We do not use mud piles. Half the things on mud piles aren't even around anymore. So the way that we look at increased anion gap acidosis is we divide them into two categories. You either have a high osmolar gap and an increased anion gap, or you have a normal osmolar gap and increased anion gap. So we don't do mud piles anymore. So when there's a high osmolar gap as well as a high anion gap, there's really only three things that we worry about. It's methanol, it's ethylene glycol, and it's polypropylene glycol. So no other gapped acidosis will increase the osmolar gap to that extent. So you just always have to know that the alcohol level is zero, because, like I said, I see a lot of people that come in with acidosis and they have a blood alcohol level of 300. So obviously that's a small molecular weight substance that's highly osmotically active. So if you have an increased osmolar gap with a blood alcohol level that's zero, then you probably have one of these disorders. So we know that methanol leads to formic acidosis. It causes both CNS disease and optic toxicity. It only takes 15 mL, half an ounce, to cause somebody to die. Ethylene glycol leads to glycolic acid and oxalic acidosis and oxalate nephropathy. And it usually causes intoxication with acute kidney injury. Lethal dose is 1.1 to 1.5 mL per kilogram. So you can imagine that's not much. It doesn't take much. You can drink a half a bottle actually, to tell you the truth, the ethylene glycol comes in gallons, but it doesn't take much to drink this. Treatment for both, thank God, is the same. It used to be alcohol, but we don't do that anymore because we can't get 95% alcohol in our hospital. Instead, we give this drug called famiprazole, which will inhibit the metabolism. It's not the actual things that were intoxicated, but rather the metabolites that cause the disease. So we give a thing called famiprazole, which I'll show you a quick picture of, and that's how we attenuate the toxicity, and then we do dialysis on these patients. If you work in an ICU and you take care of people that you're sedating with Ativan, polypropylene glycol is a diluent for Ativan, and if you go in relatively high concentrations, you can actually cause problems where you can get polypropylene glycol acidosis. So here's the picture of where famiprazole works. So either methanol, ethylene glycol they are an intoxicant but not toxic by themselves. So as long as you inhibit alcohol dehydrogenase, then you'll inhibit the production of toxins. The problem with this is it's $3,000 at a clip to do it, but it's well worth it. You know, this is just the same thing over again. So these are the beautiful birefringent calcium oxalate crystals that you're supposed to see in the urine. I never see them. So the other side of the coin, so those are the three that cause increased osmolar gap and increased anion gap. Now, if you have an increased anion gap and you have a normal osmolar gap, like it's less than 20, then you have to consider these things. You have to consider uremia. Typically, the gap is usually never more than 20, and GFR is usually less than 15 when this happens. Salicylates, which come in with a severe respiratory alkalosis with a lactic acidosis that increases the anion gap. Lactic acidosis, which is a diagnosis of many different problems. And then there's the thing called pyroglutamic acidosis, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Ketoacidosis is obviously, you can be diabetic, you can have an alcohol ketoacidosis, and you can have starvation ketosis. Quick question, do your hospital labs check acetones anymore? No, neither do I. So we used to send off for an acetone with diabetic ketoacidosis and hope that that would help us. They don't send off it anymore. The other side of the coin is actually, to tell you the truth, all the ketoacidoses are predominantly beta-hydroxybutyric acid. It just so happened that diabetic ketoacidosis just happened to have more acetone than the rest of them. So unfortunately, this is one of those diagnoses of exclusion. So we make the diagnosis based in a clinical setting. And the treatment is somewhat controversial. Believe it or not, the body likes low pH better than it likes high pH. So mortality of 7.2 is lower than the mortality of 7.6. Number two, if you have a low pH, you actually shut off production of ketoacids and you shut off productions of lactic acidosis. If you raise the pH artificially with bicarbonate, you can actually increase lactic acid production and ketoacid production. So really, there's not any evidence that actually shows that this is helpful. There's some evidence to show that it's harmful, at least in diabetic ketoacidosis. And therefore, we usually only reserve treatment for pH less than 7.1, where you have refractory hypotension or dysrhythmia. So we typically don't give bicarbonate. So the presence of a high anion gap as well as a high osmolar gap said this guy had methanol, ethylene glycol. He had optic neuritis, so that's typical of methanol. We treat him with famiprazole and treat him with dialysis. And unfortunately, he was left with severe optic deficiency later on, but he at least survived the event. And obviously, he doesn't have polypropylene glycol because he wasn't on as far as I know, there's not many people that are on Ativan drips at home. There might be, but I've never seen it, that's for sure. All right, so what are some recent things that we've seen in high anion gap acidosis? So the pyroglutamic acidosis, I will guarantee that if you do hospital work, you will see a case of this. I will guarantee that you probably see one case a year of this. So this is typically a woman. Usually some type of infectious process as an outpatient, oftentimes gastrointestinal. They come to the hospital with abdominal pain. Part of their presentation is they've been taking a lot of acetaminophen because of the pain, or they've been taking narcotics plus acetaminophen because of the pain, and they show up with this whopping acidosis. And you say, oh my God, they must be having ischemic gut. Let's take them to the OR. They take them to the OR, and they open them up, and their gut is completely normal. What they have is this thing called pyroglutamic acidosis. It's a glycine and a glutathione deficiency that is induced by acute illness plus the acetaminophen. And believe it or not, the way you treat this is you give them Valium, but you also give them N-acetylcysteine, right? Just the way you would treat acetaminophen overdoses. So I will guarantee you'll see this. You'll scratch your head and you'll say, they have a high gap, I don't know why. And you'll check a lactate, and the lactate's normal. You'll check ketones are normal. You'll check all these things, and you'll say, I don't know why they have it, but it's usually going to be pyroglutamic acidosis. And you can do actually a urine for a 5-oxyproline, at least in our lab. Polypropylene glycol, I don't know that I've ever seen a case of this, but these are people that usually typically alcoholics with severe agitated delirium that you have them on high doses of Ativan to sedate them. I mean, totally worthless, but it's one of the ways that we use to sedate them. It's usually they have to be on more than 0.1 milligram per kilogram per hour for this to happen. And you treat this the same way. It's actually, the problem with it is its metabolites are made by alcohol dehydrogenase, so you treat them with famiprazole. And there's a thing called propofol infusion syndrome. So we usually, our doses are usually 50 to 150 milligrams per minute. If you go above 150 milligrams per minute for those people that have severe agitated delirium, they can develop a severe hemodynamic instability and a lactic acidosis from propofol infusion. Well, sorry about this. Diethylene glycol is more a curiosity than anything else. You'll read about outbreaks of diethylene glycol intoxication every 10 years or so, because what it is, it's a substitute for glycerol, a cheaper substitute for glycerol that people use to make cough medicines or whatever. So a disreputable manufacturer will use this and mix this with the usual stuff, and people will, and what they do is they typically have, it's a very high fatality, it'll be an epidemic. 40 or 50 people will die because they took this, and it's because of diethylene glycol. And drug-induced lactic acidosis, we do see rarely with linezolid, we do see rarely with metformin. Metformin is kind of confusing. It almost always occurs in people that have renal failure. It almost always occurs in people that have acute kidney injury. They're always hemodynamically unstable. They're always sick as hell. And they may or may not have very high metformin levels. The cases I've always seen that I've been willing to call it are people that always that will have high metformin levels. So you can actually, if somebody comes in with a high gap acidosis and they were on metformin, you can send the lab off, you can send a metformin level off on them, and that can help with your differential diagnosis. And finally, there's a thing called D-lactic acidosis, which is an occasional board question, and it's a person who has a gapped acidosis with confusion, and it usually occurs after a carbohydrate-rich meal, and then it gets better quickly, and they send them home, and they scratch their head, and they say, I don't know what the hell's wrong with them. But if the lactic acid levels are normal and everything else is normal, and they do it several times until somebody has the bright idea, maybe this person has D-lactic acidosis. D-lactate is not checked for by regular lactate levels. And what happens to these people is they have bacterial overgrowth or some kind of gastric bypass, and they have production of D-lactate, and it causes acute confusion. And the bugs love carbohydrates, so the bugs break down carbohydrate and make D-lactate. I'm sorry about that. Okay. So next case. So we did the increased anion gap acidosis. Now I'd like to look into the people that have hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. So this is an elderly man. He comes in with tachypnea and diarrhea and weakness. And you can see here he's acidotic. His K is 6.7. His bicarbonate is 10. His anion gap is normal. And then they give you these damn urine electrolytes. And you say to yourself, why the hell did they give me urine electrolytes? I hate urine electrolytes. So how do you approach the differential diagnosis of this? So just the problem-solving case, he's acidotic, it's metabolic, compensation's appropriate. It's a normal anion gap acidosis. There's obviously no change in gap, and there's no osmolar gap. So the reason they gave you these urine electrolytes is because you can calculate a urine osmolarity. I mean, I'm sorry, a urine anion gap. It's not bad enough that we have a serum anion gap. Now we have to have a urine anion gap. But it's actually really helpful. So just like there are really only two categories with high anion gap acidosis, there's really only two categories with hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. It's those that the kidney works, the distal part of the kidney works, and they're people that can make ammonium, and they're those that the distal part of the kidney doesn't work. So you have one of those two things, and if you can figure out which one of those two things, and then you can make a differential diagnosis. So the way that we do this is we look at sodium plus potassium plus chloride. We know that in an acidic urine, you have sodium plus potassium plus ammonium are your positive, they're your cations, and chloride is your negative. So in an acidic urine, the chloride should equal the sodium plus potassium plus the ammonium. The problem is we can't measure ammonium. And because we can't measure ammonium, in an acidic urine, if there's ammonium present, the chloride should be greater than the sodium plus potassium. Does that make sense? So if there's ammonium in the urine, the chloride should be greater than the sodium plus potassium. Because we like things positives to equal negatives. So they should be equal. If they're not, then that means you're not making ammonium. And if you're not making ammonium, that means that this is the kidney's fault, okay? And so that's why we use this. So it's very useful in distinguishing disorders with normal ammonium excretion from those with abnormal. And the things that have normal urine anion gap, where the sodium and potassium are less than the chloride, are things like proximal renal tuberous acidosis or severe diarrhea. People that have abnormal urine anion gap, where the chloride is equal to or less than the sodium plus potassium, those are people that have abnormal ammonium excretion, either because they have chronic kidney disease or because they have a type 1 or a type 4 RTA. So here's the group that have normal ammonium excretion, and that can be either due to GI loss, and typically it's diarrhea that causes this, although you can have people that have long urinary loops for ileostomies because they have urinary diversions, or they have neobladders, will secrete bicarbonate and they can lose bicarbonate as well. And they used to do a crazy thing where they do a pancreas transplant and they did anastomosis to the bladder, and they would waste tons of bicarbonate. So these people have hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, but they have normal ammonium excretion. So normal ammonium excretion means that the distal part of the kidney is working fine. From the renal standpoint, you can also get this from a proximal RTA, and typically they'll show you a proximal RTA, they'll show you a patient that has other weird things. So they have a metabolic acidosis, they'll have hypophosphatemia, they'll have low uric acid because they have wasting from the proximal tubule. That's called a Fanconi syndrome. So we see this with people that have myeloma. We see this in people that have amyloidosis. We see this in people that have hypergammaglobulinemia. We also see it with drugs. So when people used to huff with toluene, they would get a proximal RTA. So people would inhale toluene. We also see with pretty commonly used drugs like acetazolamide and zanisamide and topiramate, and also tenofovir. So this is not an uncommon problem. This happens with carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, and it happens with those other drugs as well. But again, the chloride in this case is greater than the sodium plus potassium, okay? So those that have the chloride that equal to or less than are people that have abnormal acidification or regeneration of the bicarbonate. So the classic distal RTA, there's a proton pump, and the proton pump is responsible for adding the H to NH3 to make ammonium. So those people can't acidify their urine and they don't make ammonium. Then there's a type 4 RTA, which is typically hyperkalemic and the segment of the kidney that aldosterone works. And those people can't acidify they can't make ammonium because they can't excrete their hydrogen and potassium. That's type 4 RTA. And there's people that have chronic kidney disease with the GFR less than 30 mLs per minute that also have difficulty in making ammonium. So that's the three that cause this. And if you look here in people that have chronic kidney disease, which is the lower line there, they don't make ammonium. So that's if once their GFR goes below 30, then they have an abnormal urine anion gap. So if you know those two things, well, three things. If you know what the potassium is, you know what the urine pH is, and you know what the ammonium excretion is, you can figure this out. So a proximal RTA can acidify the urine. They do perfectly fine with this. They can make ammonium, so the urine anion gap is going to be normal, and their potassium is typically low. Where a distal RTA, the classic distal RTA, they can acidify their urine, so their pH of the urine is going to be more than 5, and they're going to have abnormal ammonium excretion. Where the type 4 RTA, those people typically can acidify the urine because that's not the part of the kidney, and they do have abnormal ammonium excretion, and the potassium tends to be low. And then finally, there's the people with CKD. So our patient had a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis and had an abnormal urinary gap. There wasn't any ammonium excretion, so we know it had been the kidney's problem. You remember the pH of the urine was 5, so they could acidify their urine, and the GFR was more than 30, so what we're left with is this was a type 4 renal tuberous acidosis. Okay? All right, this is just a quick this is like the intermezzo at a meal or stuff like that where they give you the sherbet, but I don't have any sherbet to give you. But this is kind of a cool science thing, okay? So why is this a cool science thing? This is a study that I wish I had done. So this is a group that took people in the ICU, and every time they did an ABG, they would send a venous blood gas off. and they would compare the PCO2, the pH, and the bicarbonate in this. So this first one is the pH, and you, if you look at that, it's totally clustered. I mean, totally in straight line, and the, if you look at the slope of the curve, the slope of the curve is one. So their venous pH, even though we used to always say when you suck somebody for a blood gas and you got venous blood, you say that's worthless. The venous pH is almost identical to the arterial pH. This is PCO2. The venous PCO2 is almost identical to the arterial PCO2. And if you look at the bicarbonate, the venous bicarbonate is almost the same as arterial bicarbonate. And if you look at the confidence intervals, you'll see that the change in pH is by 0.027, 0.03. If somebody had a pH of 7.37 versus 7.34, is that going to make a difference to you? Not me. And the PCO2, the difference is 38 to 42, so maximum 4. If somebody has a PCO2 of 42, am I going to do anything about it? No. And bicarbonate, it's only a change by 0.08. So what I'm saying to you is, why are we doing arterial blood gases? Why do we stick arteries for blood gases? I can get a saturation. Why do I need an arterial blood gas? I don't. So the only time this doesn't really work well is if you have a very low cardiac output, because there's a difference between the arterial and venous system as far as venous. They get venous acidosis in severe, low cardiac output states. And also during, when you do CPR on people, you get a big disparity between, because obviously CPR is a low cardiac output state, you get a big disparity. But in everybody else, why are we doing arterial blood gases? We shouldn't. All right. This is just what happens to my patients when I treat acidosis. So I told you not to, we probably don't need to treat hyper, we don't necessarily need to treat people that have increased anion gap acidosis unless they're severely sick. In my patients, that's a different story. If you're acidotic, this is a group of people that they gave bicarbonate supplements to that were acidotic because of CKD. And the lower group were people that you got nothing, and the upper group were people that got something. And what we're looking at is what happens to their GFR. Well, lo and behold, if we give them something simple as sodium bicarbonate, their kidneys last longer. Cheap, easy, well-tolerated, their kidneys last longer. And this is just looking at nutrition. So when you look at our patients and you treat the acidosis in chronic metabolic acidosis, then what you tend to find out is that they eat more, they feel better, they have better nutritional parameters, and their kidneys last longer. So there is a reason to treat acidosis, a chronic metabolic acidosis in people with kidney disease. All right, final part. So metabolic alkalosis. So this is a normotensive ice skater. And again, I always tell people that at least my experience has been of people that write boards use stereotypes, occupational stereotypes, and sexual stereotyping to say that, you know, if you hear ice skater, you say, that's the same as if you said a nurse, if you said a wrestler, they must have some type of eating disorder. So whenever you hear something like this where body image is important, then you have to worry about that they could have an eating disorder. So this person presents with a pH of 7.54, a PCO2 of 45, a K of 2.8, and a bicarbonate of 38. And if you look at the urine chloride, initially it was 50, and then they repeated it a day later, and it was 20. And so how would we address the differential diagnosis of this? So again, with this person has an alkalosis, it's metabolic, compensation is appropriate, anion gap is normal, so we really don't have to worry about the rest of it. But again, there's really just two types, again. So there's two types of increased anion gap acidosis, there's two types of hyperchloremic acidosis, and there are really only two types of metabolic alkalosis. What you have to know is that all metabolic alkalosis, except for that rare person where they've gotten tons of bicarbonate, all metabolic alkalosis is typically going to be because you've lost hydrogen and chloride from someplace, whether it be the gut or whether it be the kidneys. And then the reason you don't fix it is because of all the other problems. So the other problems are your hyperaldosteronism because you're dry, you're hypokalemic and you make more ammonium, which will make more bicarbonate. You're volume depleted, so you never excrete your bicarbonate that you have extra there. And what we find that is we divide these two categories into whether you're chloride responsive or not. So what does that mean? It means that if I give this person sodium chloride and potassium chloride, that I will shut off the maintenance phase. Okay, I will shut off the maintenance phase. If I give sodium chloride and potassium chloride, I will correct the potassium, I will correct the secondary hyperaldosteronism, and I will correct the volume depletion, and I will correct the maintenance phase, and then the kidneys will self-correct. If you're chloride unresponsive, that means that I can give you all this stuff in the world, and they'll never correct. Okay, I'm not going to shut down their aldosterone, okay, because the aldosterone is independent from volume. So when sodium and chloride, they usually typically restore volume and they can replete the potassium and the chloride, shutting off aldosterone production. And thus, they can put the, really, if you correct the prerenal state, then you're going to fix it yourself. And you treat this by giving sodium chloride and potassium chloride. You could even give whatever, magnesium chloride. You could give any type of chloride. It's actually chloride is the most important part of this. So what are these types? Well, that's typically what you get with diuretics, right, all the time. Chloridorrhea is this weird thing that people get with chloride type of diarrhea. I've seen one case with a villous adenoma that can happen. When people have high PCO2s and you intubate them or put them on BiPAP and suddenly their CO2s are normal, that's post-hypercapnic, that's chloride responsive. You stick an NG tube or you vomit and you lose hydrogen and chloride from there, that's chloride responsive. There's a thing called milk alkali syndrome, which is usually typically you're taking calcium carbonate or magnesium hydroxide or whatever, and you vomit at the same time. And then finally cystic fibrosis, where you have high skin chloride loss. So the milk alkali used to be due to antacids in large quantities of milk, but we see it more just because of people taking vitamin D and calcium carbonate. I have to say that vitamin D by itself doesn't typically cause hypercalcemia. Just the regular 25-hydroxy vitamin D, the numbers of hypercalcemia I see from that is really uncommon. But when you take a lot of calcium carbonate, that's a different story. The chloride unresponsive alkalosis are those people that you can give all the chloride you want and you won't shut off aldosterone. So they either have primary or secondary elevations of aldosterone that have nothing to do with volume. And you can administer, so in those people, you actually have to get rid of bicarbonate. So you have to give things like acetazolamide or hydrochloric acid, which we don't give anymore, which was kind of fun to give because it worked perfectly, or spironolactone to shut off the area of the kidney that's responsible for the alkalosis. So these are people that have aldoexis, these are the people that have Mark was talking about, that have Kahn syndrome. Or these are people that are on steroids. I mean, if you give somebody prednisone every day or Salumedrol every day, that has mineralocorticoid activity, so it's like giving them aldosterone every day. They can also have secondary aldosterone excess because they're in heart failure. So obviously, heart failure doesn't get better when you give sodium chloride and potassium chloride. Cirrhosis, renal artery stenosis, the thing called Bartter syndrome or hypomagnesemia. Hypomagnesemia hypomagnesemia actually causes secondary hyperaldosteronism. And then they can have some weird syndromes like Bartter syndrome and Gittleman syndrome. They look like they're taking furosemide or thiazide diuretics. So this person had a metabolic alkalosis with initially a high urine chloride. That's what distinguishes high from low. This is what distinguishes chloride responsive from chloride unresponsive. But once we got them into the hospital and stopped the diuretics, the urine chloride went to less than 20. And after we confronted the person, they admitted that they use diuretics to maintain their weight. And we were able to treat them with correction. Alkalosis is clearly the poor sister. It doesn't really have a whole lot of cool stuff going on. In our hospital, when we ventilate patients at 6 mLs per kilogram for ARDS, they don't mind that the CO2 goes up, so sometimes we have to give bicarbonate to make them give them a metabolic alkalosis. And then finally, they actually found pretty cool, like you hear creatine and all this other crap, what they actually found works for people that improves their endurance is if you take sodium bicarbonate before exercise, and you can actually do more. Pretty safe way to do it. Even taking Tums, which are calcium carbonate, which is like sodium bicarbonate, can do the same.